I'm just gonna do a brief intro.
Okay.
Hand it over to you. Sit down.
Perfect.
This is like right in your face, eh?
Can't miss it. Good evening. My name is Bob Lewis. My pleasure to welcome you here to our regular series of forums for the winter, and nice turnout, such an uncomfortable evening, but I think it has a comment on the excellent panel we have here tonight. I want to thank, as I always do, the BMO Financial Group for their generous support of this series. Before I turn things over to Melissa, I just wanted to give you a quick report. We're off, I have to tell you, to a very good start at CJF, and we've actually received several new commitments from new contributors as well as old, so that's a good thing. That means that we're very confident about continuation of our funding for JSOURCE and Projet J, which we do in companionship with the journalism schools. And we're working very closely with the schools to make sure that we secure and enrich those two websites, which have been, I think, for us and for people who follow journalism, a fantastic asset. We've also got a strong lineup of programming through the rest of the year, and I'm going to say a brief word at the end about that. And we're working on some new initiatives that will focus on young journalists and minorities, and hopefully a more accessible management education program in terms of the costs. So with that, I'd like to say a brief thank you to Marissa Nelson, who, as you all know, probably, she's acting director of digital media for CBC News. She's been managing editor of cbcnews.ca since 2010. Previously, Marissa was the senior editor of digital news for the Toronto Star and its other properties, including thestar.com. She started in newspapers at the Hamilton Spectator and the London Free Press and covered some major assignments in that process. So Marissa, with that, we welcome you to the stage as the moderator, and thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Bob. And thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm thrilled to be moderating the panel tonight. I'm going to run through just quickly the agenda before I introduce you to the fantastic panelists we have today. So we're going to spend about 45 minutes with the panelists discussing some questions. Then we'll have about 30 to 35 minutes for questions from the floor and from Twitter. Remember, the hashtag is hashtag CJFJTalk. So there's two J's and there's no S, CJFJTalk. And at the end, of course, you can tweet us your questions and we'll try to get to as many as possible. So without further ado, I'll introduce you to the fantastic panelists. First, I'll start on my right is Michael DeMonte. He is the CEO of Scribble Live. He founded Scribble Live in 2008 with Jonathan Keebler. Michael started in the new media business in 1983.
Old.
He's been part of every major publishing revolution as it's happened. The end of typesetting with digital page layouts.
I remember
Waxers.
Those. Desktop publishing?
Yes. CD-ROMs as the new medium for big data. Desktop video and the studio in your lap. The internet and the dawn of community. And today, the age of social. After being responsible for more than a dozen content management systems, he witnessed the barriers firsthand of the impediments the newsrooms and content creators faced and envisioned a product that would allow real-time collaborative storytelling. Today, Scribble Live serves millions of readers with billions of minutes of content every month. And little known fact, before Scribble, Michael also spent time in digital at CTV and Chum.
Thank you.
Next to Michael is Zach Seward. Zach is the senior editor of Quartz, which launched in September. For any of you who don't know Quartz, though you all should, you can find it at qz.com. It's a global news business website owned by Atlantic Media Company, which also, of course, owns Atlantic Monthly. It's optimized for tablet and mobile devices. And when I say that, I actually think we have a lot to learn from how they've optimized their site. It's quite amazing. Until February 2012, Zach was the editor of outreach and social media for the Wall Street Journal, where he led a team of journalists who built news for the social web, and he wrote about technology and culture. Before that, he covered education and health for the Wall Street Journal's Boston Bureau. In the academic realm, Zach is an adjunct professor at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute, teaching a class in digital journalism. It goes on. In 2010, he taught social media at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And before that, he helped start the Nieman Journalism Lab, where he was assistant editor, covering media industry innovation in online journalism. He attended Harvard College, majored in African American studies, and wrote for The Crimson, but didn't graduate, which maybe we'll hear about later. Finally, in 2011, Forbes named Zach to its list of 30 under 30 in media. Last, but definitely not least, David Skok on the end, on the right. David is director of digital for Global News, overseeing all product editorial business development for globalnews.ca network. He is the co-author of Breaking News, Mastering the Art of Disruptive Innovation in Journalism, a framework he developed with the world-renowned innovative expert and Harvard Business School professor Clayton Christensen, who actually coined the term disruptive innovation. In 2011, David was the Martin Wise Goodman Fellow at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University, the first digital journalist in Canada selected for this honor. David began his career at ABC's Nightline. He began working at Global in 2003, and in 2009, he co-created the globalnews.ca network, consisting of 11 national and local news websites with an umbrella national site. I didn't know this, actually, until this event. David was born in Johannesburg, South Africa. Came to Canada in 1988. He's a graduate of Western and Ryerson. So, without further ado, I'm going to launch into it. What I think is interesting about all of these panelists is that they all have ties to traditional newsrooms. Zach is now in a startup with ties to traditional media. Michael is in a much more strict startup environment. And David is in a traditional newsroom but is looking at innovation from an academic standpoint. So the title of this session is Journalism Disrupted: How to Create Media Innovation. So my first question is, what innovations have fundamentally shifted journalism? Who wants to jump in? David?
Start with David.
Okay.
Well, thanks. First of all, let me say thank you. It's delightful to be here. And to Zach, thanks for coming. And don't feel bad about not graduating Harvard. I think there's a couple others that we know of who ended up having pretty good careers after not graduating.
A few that we don't know of, too. Yeah.
In thinking about what innovations have fundamentally changed journalism, I always kind of preface this with the understanding that we need to take a step back and first understand how you define innovation. And it's important to do that. The way that Clay, the professor that Marissa mentioned that I worked with, the way that he would define innovation is that there's really three different types of innovation. There's the sustaining innovations, which are the ones that improve how you do your existing jobs and make your product better. So in the case of television newsrooms like my own, microwave and satellite trucks help to do that. There are low-end efficiency innovations, which help you do your job better, but don't necessarily create jobs. So in that sense, also in the TV world, we have things like robotic cameras, which actually eliminated people in the newsroom, but actually made the product more innovative and more efficient. And then there is the one that I think is the premise for the discussion tonight, which is the disruptive or empowering innovations. And in that sense, to answer Marissa's question, I would say that the smartphones, Wi-Fi, 4G, I think is at present the most innovative thing that we've seen change the way we do things. And I think Quartz is a great example of that. You know, you being able to use, to redesign websites responsively, or tell living articles the way Michael does with Scribble Live. These are all new ways of telling stories. Twitter is a new way of telling stories. And we saw that. The one that really comes to mind for me is the plane crash on the Hudson, which really kind of was that encapsulating moment that showed that this was a different time and that the audience had as much input into what news gathering we did as traditional journalists.
Thanks. Sure. I mean, I guess I'd have to say if I were picking just one innovation, would be innovation in publishing systems. You know, maybe I should leave that to Michael to talk more about. But systems that have lowered the barrier to entry for publishing on the web, where, you know, so that like the fundamental disruption, right, is it's like publishing no longer requires the machinery
it once did and is merely a matter of clicking a button. That changes all sorts of things about whom we as journalists are competing with and sort of the nature of what we think of as publishing. And I think we're about to see a whole flood of even better, newer tools that even further reduce the friction between having a thought and publishing that on the web. You know, you can't imagine right now that like there could be anything more seamless than sending a tweet. And I would imagine that this year we sort of see a whole new publishing systems that actually prove that wrong.
Michael, you've talked a lot about live coverage.
I think for me, I'd have to kind of encapsulate it all around what I'd call the real-time web. To David and Zach's point, I mean, both of them are kind of hinting on this new phenomenon around social media. And social media has changed the way people absorb content. It's obvious. You know, you sit on Twitter, you sit on Facebook, you sit on Google Plus, whatever social media is your pet of the day. You're constantly inundated with content. It's constantly updating and it's constantly real time. And even today, it's still, for me, it's surprising that it's taken over 30 years for us to go from CNN, which was, you know, your consummate live news channel, and we're still barely scratching the surface on real-time live news. It's still fundamentally not happening on the web. You think it is, you know, when you get a tweet and you're getting information, but at the end of the day, you're always getting these little morsels and that are not telling the entire story. And the real-time web is now enabling all of those connections to start to come together, where you can access not only the social media side of the business and bringing in, you know, what others have to say, but now you can empower journalists to tell those stories at the same speed as social media.
Is anybody going to mention, well, even sites like Quartz, but I guess BuzzFeed is a very traditional place for people to point in terms of just being disruptive to the journalism field. Would you call BuzzFeed disruptive, David?
Yeah, absolutely. It's and it was actually the case that we cited in some of our work. You know, we looked at disruptive innovation as a theory, and what is asserts is that the mechanism that causes successful companies to fail is not that they're actually bad at anything, but rather that somebody comes in at the bottom of the market and moves up. And it's that mechanism of the pursuit of profit at the bottom of the market that makes it so hard to actually sustain success at the top of the market. And so when you had sites like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, which are fighting to prove that they're the quality ones to grow audiences and expand, what they're actually end up doing is opening up the bottom of the market for disruptors like BuzzFeed to come in and start taking more audience share away. BuzzFeed, it was a predecessor to BuzzFeed, which was Huffington Post, which really created new market audiences. And I would even argue that their predecessor to that, as we've seen, is Time Magazine. Time Magazine was an aggregator of content in 1929 when it first started, and then moved its way up into original content. So yeah, BuzzFeed is probably the best example that I can think of.
Okay. So, Michael, Zach, you're no longer working in traditional newsrooms or with traditional organizations. Are there fewer obstacles to innovation outside of the traditional network or a newsroom?
Yes. I am totally sympathetic to the challenges faced by legacy news organizations in attempting to pull off the sort of innovation you're talking about. There's no question that it's easier to do when you're starting with a blank slate, starting from scratch. I mean, even, you know, for the trajectory for us at Quartz was, all right, you know, we have this charge, you want to build a global business news website optimized for tablet and mobile, going after a certain type of audience that we can sell advertising against, and then, like, I could go make that, and that was the challenge, right? And so we had, you know, maybe 5 months, 6 months to pull that off and launch, and I think the opportunity for innovation was greatest at that moment, and we even feel it now. Like the and trying to move a ship that now exists is just harder. You have people with roles that now exist, and you have to deal with that. You've made decisions that maybe need reevaluating as opposed to just mm-hmm. conceiving from scratch. So I these are all the challenges that are felt even greater at a place that's been around for a century.
So, in having that initial upstart and that open, wide open field in which to create, is now that you're actually into it, is there more space for innovation?
I would hope so. It's certainly the goal, right? So you, it's as much like a culture question, right? Mm-hmm. We try to have a culture at Quartz that emphasizes constantly reevaluating and questioning the choices that we've made, not feeling too beholden to particular norms, essentially not assuming that there's something that, you know, we ought to do something just because we thought it that way. And so, you know, for instance, if you go to QZ.com, one thing you'll notice is there's not exactly really like a homepage. We just kind of drop you into our top story. Now, I have no idea if that was the right decision. That's for all of you to tell us. But when we were evaluating this question of like what it should be our homepage, a lot of the assumptions that are typically made about a news homepage didn't make sense for us in 2012, and so we threw it out. And I got proud of having been able to do that, and then the challenge is to continue doing that, I think.
Okay. Michael.
Yes, or I wouldn't have quit my job. So I'll come at from a little a different angle, and that is, while I was inside the newsroom back in 2006, we had so many challenges around content management systems and technology just in general. When you're a huge media corporation and you're buying all kinds of divisions over the course of a decade, you're surrounded by, in our case, I think, well over a dozen major technologies that were responsible for creating and publishing content. And when you... And having been the director of online production, which is essentially anything that needed to be done in that business, which was well over 100 properties when CTV finally swallowed, most of the media organizations here in Canada, to get anything done, you had to go through me. And I had such a hard time scheduling as much stuff that needed to be done. What happened is innovation suffered because people wanted to kind of move forward and get into all of these new and interesting things and put social on all the pages and do all these great things, but it was impossible to get it all done while still maintaining all the other sites that needed to function. And when I was removed from that, and then I started to go back and look at these organizations, and often organizations are always choosing the concepts of, well, I'm going to build rather than buy. And the trouble with building and not buying is that you end up building something that once it's built will get no attention after it's finished. Even organizations as large as the New York Times, even when they build something, you don't necessarily continue to have the ear of development and be able to push that product further and further along on its curve. Because what will happen is you'll get a tool for doing X, whatever X is, and then they're going to move on to building whatever Y needs to do. And then when X needs innovation, you're stuck because they're building Z. And you end up, in most cases, years behind whatever could be done outside of your business. And that's kind of where I came in. The reason why I left the business was there was no chance that I could ever build what I wanted to build inside and maintain a product that would consistently be better week over week or month over month and continue to innovate. And that's the main reason why I left the newsroom. I'm not saying it can't be done. I just say there's immense challenges when you're trying to build internally and you're always running into walls. And often you're building behind because you're building what is hot right now. You're not building what's going to be hot in a year from now or a month from now. If that helps.
It does. So you were the bottleneck for innovation is what you're saying.
I was.
CTV, okay.
Only because, we had to get the ads out.
All right, fair enough. So, David, a specific question for you, because a lot of the folks who are in this room, I would guess, are from traditional newsrooms. I'm certainly from traditional newsrooms. You studied innovation last year at Harvard. How do we protect or spark innovation in traditional newsrooms? So these guys have talked about it in sort of the new startup world. What can we do inside our world?
Yeah, and they've actually touched on the key issue, both of them, which is culture. It really all does come down to culture, and it's funny because often when we talk about the future of news and what needs to be done, we talk about paywalls and business models, and that stuff is important, absolutely, and I'm sure we'll talk about that tonight at some point. But really, the intangible thing that needs to be addressed and the giant elephant in the room is culture. So I work in a traditional newsroom, but we are doing something within a traditional newsroom that I would argue is disruptive. And the reason why we're able to do that is, and Clay's research is really, really clear on this, you have to keep it separate. Culture, if you were to look at it, what is culture? Culture can be defined, or at least the way we defined it was, all the resources, which is all the equipment, the CMSs, the salaries that you have, and the people you have to get your product out there. Then there's the processes, which are the intangible, invisible things that happen when you exchange from, let's say I was making a widget X, having the person label widget X and then hand it off to the next person. That process is part of culture. And then the priorities that are set at the very high end of the company, which are essentially driven by profit margins. And so when you take the resources, the processes, and the priorities, all of that together makes up culture. It's really difficult to change all of that within an existing organization that has a profit margin that it has to keep, that has existing cultural processes that it has to keep in place to do the existing product. So in my case, it's producing a newscast for television. That's a process that needs to happen, and they're very good at that. There's a reason why they're doing that, and the resources are all there to serve that purpose. So you then are saying, okay, well, now do something disruptive. Clay's research argues there is absolutely no way you can ever throw something into that culture and have it work. It'll simply get swallowed every single time. And so there's three ways to really address that. The one way is to create new capabilities internally, so to actually have a separate unit within that newsroom that has its own culture. And the New York Times has done this with its data interactive group. You know, they stuck a whole bunch of developers and they stuck a whole bunch of journalists together and they said, okay, go play. And you guys are not beholden to the margins and the priorities that we're setting for the rest of the business. Go play in the space and innovate. Then there's the option of creating a spin-off organization, which essentially is what Quartz is. The Atlantic has pushed aside and said, okay, you know, try this QZ and see what you can do there, and you have your own profit margins, and I'm sure are very different to what the Atlantic's corporate profit margins are. And then there's the option of acquiring an existing organization. All three of those options are essentially standalone items. The key takeaway being that you simply cannot fundamentally change an organization internally within its existing culture.
Okay, so to be devil's advocate for a second,
sure.
A lot of people in this room aren't the deciders and people who will decide the structure of their organization. Is there something they can do to spark innovation in traditional newsrooms in a day-to-day way?
Well, they are the resources, right, as part of this culture, and they are part of the processes. And so I would say take a look at yourself, take a hard look, and see if you are doing the tasks every day that are helping your company get towards an innovative culture. But the other thing I would say is really just get to know the people in the organization, like the IT teams, like the engineering teams, that can give you the space to experiment. So in Michael's case, you know, get to know the IT guys that'll then open up the firewalls that are in the priorities, and you know, maybe they'll slip them a 20 and they'll do you a favor so that you can go and experiment and change the tasks that you're doing every day. To say that you can't do it because you're just a frontline worker is, I don't believe that. I think I'm actually living proof of that. When I started at Global, I was able to patch together a live stream for free by just going into a computer and becoming friends with the IT guy and patching through a cable, and next thing you knew, we were live streaming. It can be done. You just have to push those tasks really as far as you can take them.
Okay, so I'm going to change tacks a little bit here. Innovation is often, when we talk about it, we're talking about it in terms of content. So what about business model innovations? Are paywalls, advertorials the innovation there? Zach? It's an interesting model at the Atlantic.
Yeah, so Quartz is entirely free, right? We're going up, or our competitors we name publicly are places like The Economist, The Financial Times, my former employer, et cetera, right? For the most part, they're all subscription websites. And there's a huge benefit to that. They have two revenue streams coming in, advertising and subscriptions. My time at the Journal came to really sympathize with that choice and see it probably as having been like among the smartest decisions that company ever made. You know, all that being said, it nevertheless, you know, sets them up as susceptible to an upstart that comes in completely free and is as a result, or you know, this is our bet, able to grow much more rapidly with fewer resources. Right. So I mean, that's generally the situation that David's describing, and is our strategy. So, paywall question was not or didn't. Frankly, I don't even know we had a whole meeting about it. Like that was never really in the cards. I mean, I suppose we don't preclude it down the line. But being free was really important to us, and a really key reason for that. This is also the reason we you know, despite having a mobile and tablet focus, are you know, decided to build a website and not an app that you download in an app store. You know, we thought that the only way to grow really rapidly was if we produced good stuff that people cared to share. You know, going to the trends that Michael was talking about, we were going to grow or not grow on the back of the social web. Like it was, we were going to make stuff that people really liked, and they were going to feel compelled to share it on Twitter and on Facebook, and mm-hmm. that would bring us our audience. So. Social media is just simply not compatible with a paywall, and it's not compatible with app stores either. You know, this idea that I might tell you about, probably know the story of the Daily News Corp's sort of admirable experiment in iPad-only publishing. You know, it's sort of the comical situation where you're trying to tell someone that there was this fantastic story in the Daily yesterday. You just need to go grab your iPad and open up the App Store, download the Daily. I think you get a 7-day free trial, so you don't have to worry about that for the moment, but just swipe 33 times because it's on page 33. And sorry, it was in yesterday's edition, so it's gone and you can't read it. And it's absurd versus the, you know, it feels silly for me to say that like a feature of Quartz is that you can share an individual link to a story. But the reality we're in at the moment is actually that for a number of news outlets, that's just not simply not possible. You can, but your followers will hit a wall. So there's that. Then in choosing to be free, we obviously needed to make money somehow. We have an events business that's growing this year. But our money right now is the money we're making is through advertising. It's two types of advertising: display advertising. We're not serving traditional display ads. We're going after an experience we hope is more akin to a glossy magazine. So they're larger. They're built in HTML5 and not Flash, and served by they're served by us, which allows for, we hope, some innovative ad types. And then the other type of advertising is sometimes referred to as native advertising. We call it sponsor content. And that is articles that are written by and paid for by the advertiser themselves with the appropriate disclosure so that the reader is never confused as to what's going on. Those are the two types. We find so far that advertisers are very interested in both and have a lot of hope in both models, but you know, there's a ton of buzz about the latter model. So far so good, we think, but it's new terrain for us.
So interesting point, two things, that the quality of the advertising affects the overall editorial experience, which I think is an important point. Can we pause briefly on the sponsored content? Because there has been some controversy around some of that. Do you want to talk about that briefly?
Yeah, I mean, so The Atlantic, which is our parent or sister news outlet, published a piece of sponsor content from the Church of Scientology a week or two ago that was pretty widely derided almost as soon as it went up, and then was taken down and led to a sort of a rethink within the company about some of the standards that had led that to happen and how it might be prevented in the future. So that's, they actually released new guidelines for sponsor content yesterday. And I mean, the upshot is it should at no point be unclear to the reader what's going on, that this is paid for and written by the advertiser. And so there's some stuff in the new guidelines about just kind of making that really explicit, because a lot of these terms are, right, they're new, and so you can't expect readers to necessarily understand them. And then, you know, I think there's just the reality that we're playing around with it and seeing what works. An interesting element of sponsor content is it puts, as you say, a lot on the content itself. Like, the ideal is, and BuzzFeed's in this business quite heavily, is that this is actually stuff someone might want, you know, God forbid, actually want to read and maybe even share. And it's not really a new model. The Nation of Russia buys an entire section in the New York Times and the Washington Post on a regular basis. Inserts in magazines from Monocle to the New Yorker are very common, but pulling it off online is a little different, and it does put a lot on the content. It has to be good, and you know, BuzzFeed's idea is, well, we make content that's along the lines of what BuzzFeed editorial content looks and feels like, but incorporates the sponsor somehow. Ours is that these sponsors have, you know, their own issues that they, that they want to address, and that they take the space to address it the way they might write an op-ed elsewhere. And then I put up my hands, and as do the rest of us in the newsroom, and have no, you know, they deal with the ad side, and we have no involvement in what they do at that point.
Do you mind if I just?
Yeah.
I actually really want to take a second to defend The Atlantic on this one, because
expecting that.
It got a lot of heat, and I felt a lot of it was unwarranted for a couple of reasons. One, this weekend is the Super Bowl, and I suspect that most of the people in this room are going to watch the Super Bowl for the game, but also to watch the commercials. And I'm one of those people. The commercials are part of the experience of watching the game. And we talk about in the paper the theory of jobs to be done, and that you're satisfying, fulfilling the needs of the audience or whatever else. Mm-hmm. Vogue magazine or any fashion magazine spends half of the content on ads, and people actually buy the magazine for the ads. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at this example, and ultimately, yes, you want that sweet spot of being able to get it as close to being enjoyable, readable content like the magazine is. What's wrong with that? The editorial issues that go along with that, absolutely. I suspect that was just a bureaucratic, inexperienced, learn-as-you-go type thing, in the same way that, we don't accept political advertising unless it's during the campaign, you know, just policy things that needed to be sorted out. But the way that people jumped on The Atlantic for that, in the midst of saying, you know, paywalls suck, and then to turn around and say, well, sponsored content, look how stupid it is as well, I just thought it was disingenuous. I just wanted to say that.
Okay.
Thank you. real quick on that, I think the episode fundamentally showed was just that even that type of content, as of course is the case with editorial content, it just needs to uphold certain standards and levels of honesty and et cetera. And readers will be, as you noted, very harsh if it doesn't.
If you clearly mark it, what else do you need to do? Yeah.
Michael, jump in here.
Yeah, I was going to say that kind of two things. One, media companies should stop buying media companies. I mean, if you want to innovate, don't buy another newspaper or another television station. If you take somebody like, you know, Rogers as an example, and I mean, even if you think about Ted Rogers, you know, before he passed away, he actually was... a very startup-oriented guy. He created things that he thought the public wanted and that the public was willing to pay for. You know, when he built his mobile empire, he did that out of his own money. None of that money came from Rogers. They were not interested in the cellular community. And Rogers actually is an early investor in our company. And the reason why they are is not simply because, you know we're a shiny object. You know, they're a media company that needs to get into innovation. And one way to get into innovation is to buy it and own a piece of it and make sure that your organization is adopting it. It's a great way to push it down the chain. And when I think about advertising and some of the comments made here, I'm a big fan of content marketing. Maybe we'll talk about that in the next question. But I think one of the worst things that ever happened to media and the web was that, you know, back in the day when, you know, a lot of organizations were catching up, you know, they basically looked at the web and they looked at a newspaper and they said, let's do that on the web. So I'm going to take a story and I'm going to jam it on a page and I'm going to take an ad and I'm going to jam an ad beside it. And you guys have been stuck in that metaphor for I don't know how many years now. And it was perhaps the worst thing, in my opinion, that ever happened to media, because that's not what people are going to do on the web. The web was always a naturally flowing way to get information. It was very fluid. It was non-linear, and they were jamming a linear experience. This way of flipping through pages and trying to replicate it on the web, and the whole advertising model, in my opinion, broke down. That's why, if you look today, the whole idea of click-throughs and CPMs, that's dying, because now it's all about engagement. You know, social media is forcing engagement on people, and new advertising models need to be recognized. And I think when that happens, you're going to start to see content be much, much more in the forefront, because content is engaging. If you can keep people interested in what you have to say for long periods of time, talk to television, that's what they do. If you can get them on these story arcs, I think some people refer to it as flight path, but that concept of a story that's told over time where it has lots of information coming in and summary and lots of information, and it's a way to captivate an audience. And if you're captivating them for 10 or 15 minutes as a story is unfolding, whether it's sports or breaking news or anything that can be told in this way, trials, all kinds of different kinds of coverage, that audience is worth way more from an engagement point of view than they ever would be from a CPM point of view. And you cannot replicate that on newsprint, or you cannot replicate that on television. And I think those kinds of new advertising models, when they start to surface, and this new engagement model that starts to take place, you're going to start to see a rebound on the content side.
Do you think that's what's driving this idea of sponsored content?
I hope so. I'm banking on it. Yes, and when I look, you know, I was just going to roll into this next question,
yeah,
if
yeah.
It's all right. I mean, when I look at content and traditional organizations and where they're trying to innovate, I mean, if you want to really look to where people know how to innovate when it comes to content, look to big brands. And everybody knows Red Bull, right? Can you imagine if Red Bull simply did a press release of a guy jumping out of a, you know, out from space? Oh, here's a press release. Wasn't that fun? You know, that kind of content marketing is what ends up paying the bills. You know, you get somebody like a Red Bull basically gets picked up by every single major news organization around the world. Why? Because they're innovating on what people actually want to read about and what people are interested in. So they take a fantastic idea like that and they push it through the system as content marketing, and everybody swallows it up. And I'm a big fan of content marketing, and I agree with both of you. There's nothing wrong with it. There's always been you know, different levels of acceptance on what people are willing to count as authoritative sources and sort of secondary sources. But a lot of these content pieces are being written by journalists. They're being written by people who know how to write and are taking a journalistic aspect of whatever they're creating and the content they're creating. As long as it's authentic and as long as it's not selling you crap, it's a great story about whatever it might be. If it's about how religion is affecting, you know, the economy, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's taking a view and not necessarily pushing an opinion.
With the caveat.
With the caveat that it's sponsored content.
That yeah. It's sponsored content and that, in my view at least, it's separate from the editorial team. That the people doing it sure. are not in the newsroom telling stories, journalism, and holding people accountable.
Yeah. Well, and the Red Bull example is an interesting one because everybody covered it as if it was a...
It's a news story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Interesting. Can we pause for a second maybe on content? Because we've been talking a lot about business models. David was talking a bit about content at the beginning. What can, again, not everybody in this room are the people who are the deciders of how their actual organizations are structured. Are there things that they can be doing to spark that innovation when it comes to content in their own newsrooms?
Sure. Just a few real quick things. One thing that's working really well for us is to tell every writer at courts to assume that when they hit publish or when their editor hits publish on a story, their piece starts with an audience of zero. And it's up to them to earn the audience from there. To just assume that if we just hit publish and did nothing else, no one would read it. And which is frankly more or less true for any site, certainly us included, starting in 2012, where fewer and fewer people are making homepages part of their news experience and instead are finding their news in social media. So, it's incumbent on us to have our stuff find its way there. Now, that's a real challenge. It's a little, certain people can be a little depressing or otherwise concerning, but it's also a cool opportunity, and it means for any individual, in our newsroom, but frankly any newsroom, the opportunity is a lot greater than it used to be, than when you might have had to, when fighting for space on your homepage was like the most important thing you could do to get people to read your content. Then of course how you might produce the kind of stuff that people are willing to share in social media is a whole other question that I'm happy to talk about. But that's one. And then something just to reiterate that David said, finding an ally who knows how to code, if that's not you, in your newsroom and going off in the corner together is never a bad idea.
Hiding in a closet,
yeah.
In the back corner. All right. So we talked a bit. David, I think, mentioned earlier that one of the biggest obstacles is culture, and he talked about sort of the different parts of the process that makes up culture. If one of our biggest obstacles to innovation is a legacy culture, can we actually change that? Please don't say no.
Maybe.
if you look at what's the classic Schumpeter, I can never pronounce the name, but take a look at the Fortune 500 companies and how many were there in 1980, and you'll see that it was very few. So it is a natural course of the evolution of business life, that companies come and go, and that's part of the evolution. I would say that I'm incredibly optimistic in interpreting a lot of the theories and looking at companies over the last year that journalism will survive and thrive. Journalism is here to stay, and people will find a way to produce journalism and high-quality journalism continuing moving forward. I mean, I think the Huffington Post winning a Pulitzer Prize last year for a very traditional report was such a watershed moment to say, we're going to make it okay. Traditional newsrooms, we're in for a tougher haul. The good news is that we often, many of us in at least the digital departments, we're not in a position where we are a slave to money yet, because if we're profitable, we may be profitable by a few pennies. And so that does give us the freedom to experiment a little bit more and create a little bit more of an innovative experimental culture than you would see in a traditional side of the business. So I would say, look as much to the digital side of the business for the innovation, while the incumbent legacy part of the business continues to make profit, at least on the broadcast side. I know I can't really speak for print as much.
But you would argue, too, that if you start to squeeze the digital to get the profits, that you're going to stifle innovation, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Although you can be patient for growth, but you have to be impatient for profits. You have to expect that I know Duncan, who's in the audience here, the post-media, on one of the previous CJF panels, were talking about a site that they had done, and they're a very small team, and they're a great example of it. It's critical that they start small and are profitable from the early days. Yeah. And then, even if it's just making a dollar profit, scaling up from that is a far better strategy than rapidly expanding and then having to pay those bills at the end of the month.
Okay. Zach, do you think we can change? You were at the Wall Street Journal for a long time. Think we can change traditional newsroom
There's
culture?
The reason he left.
That's not the reason. which is not to say it's hopeless for all of us at all. I just think it like behooves us to have wide open eyes about the profound effects that digital has on a whole host of industries. So like you're at a TV production company right now, you're not exactly feeling it. Certainly not quite the way newspaper companies are, but you will be. It's inevitable. You're at a law firm right now. You haven't even thought about how digital disrupts your industry. You're a professor in higher education. I would only think of like the fatalism that I guess I start with here is actually I would argue is necessary to head off any the most disastrous effects that this kind of disruption has on legacy businesses. And frankly, I mean, because you're pointing right, all right, we're not talking about the utmost decision makers here. It's like anyone in a newsroom right now. Like, it's actually, that's a better position to be in, I think, and one where that kind of fatalism is actually, I would say, useful, but that might just be a personality trait.
No, absolutely. Necessity breeds innovation, right? I mean, you have to feel like the panic button is pressed in order to really push the buttons. I agree with that.
Michael? I know what you're going to say.
You do you?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. I think the most obvious thing I can think of is that today, news organizations still call it digital. Like, why are we constantly referring to the separation of digital and traditional? If you're still doing that, you already have a massive problem. Like, you shouldn't even be talking about whatever quote-unquote traditional used to be. It's over. It's been done for 20 years. The fact that we're still referring to it as digital and you're part of the digital revolution, are you kidding me? I mean, we're all carrying around devices in our hands that you can basically get information from anywhere around the world instantly, and we're still talking about a traditional news organization. It's over, and it's been over for a long time. And I think once they recognize that, what I can say is that storytellers will always be necessary. Great journalism and great writing and great storytelling will always be necessary on whatever medium or device or product you pick up, and that will survive. Do I think that the news infrastructure as it stands today will survive? No. I think it's going to continue to change and continue to evolve, and something will come out of it. I don't know what that landscape's going to look like.
Okay, but if you were talking to a 25-year-old fantastic storyteller who's working at a newspaper who might possibly be sitting in the audience, for instance, what would you say to them about changing the culture? Just get out?
Quit your job. Hmm. Honestly, because they're not going to move fast enough for you. If you are really a 25-year-old something who has innovation on the brain and you really want to step out of the traditional news organization and get into something that is really interesting, find a job somewhere else that you can actually take that passion that you have and apply it someplace where it will work. Perhaps it's at courts, right, perhaps it's at an organization like that, but it's not going to be at an organization that still talks about traditional.
Okay, director of globalnews.ca, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, director of the fastest growing online news website in Canada. There's a reason for that, right? I mean, to suggest that it's going away, we still, our broadcast
side, I didn't say that.
No,
I said it's going to change.
So, I mean, our broadcast arm, as far as I know, and there's probably somebody in the audience who has better stats, we still get 1.5 million viewers a night. Canadians rely and trust traditional media for a reason. And look, I'm being a little bit hypocritical here because I'm the same person who will talk about the innovator's dilemma, right? Which is, I'm now using the excuse of, look at how all those people that still watch us, while at the same time we're being disrupted from below. But I do think that some media organizations are trying to build the necessary things. I think The Atlantic is a great example of that. Are trying to build these separate organizations that can hopefully build it up.
I didn't mean to say traditional. In other words, legacy. I would call you legacy, not traditional. Organizations that are shifting to digital innovation will survive. I'm not suggesting that traditional in the sense of, because you've been around for 50 years or 100 years and you're still creating really great content, that you can't continue to do that. But the fact that you still refer to it as traditional is what I'm arguing. You shouldn't be referring. You are now an innovator in your space, and you should be always referring to yourself as a content creator or a news creator, but not a traditional news organization. That's what I'm saying. I was never suggesting that traditional just should be referred to as almost as legacy, rather than getting stuck on this idea. Because traditional to me means newspapers. It means dead trees. It means that kind of thing, rather than moving forward into the new age of communications and the new ages of delivery, which you guys have done and have been innovating in that way. Sorry, David, I just went.
Hey,
yeah.
Oh, I was just going to be optimistic for a second and advocate not quitting.
Good.
You know, I had a load of fun at the Journal, and I think there are a number of reasons why. One is like a boss whom I loved working for and who let us like have a little space of our own. You know, finding someone like that in an organization is doable. It was also like a really interesting challenge. Like the Journal is a part, is like about, you know, half or so of its content is behind a paywall, half or so is free, and you know, doing social media in that kind of environment, it's like, yeah, it's not the easiest thing in the world, but it was kind of a cool challenge. And it, you know, as someone who I think actually went in pretty skeptical of paywalls, and as you could hear me saying earlier, like I'm no fan of them today either, but I grew to appreciate that challenge and learn something from it. I hope so, you know, and the Journal that has taught me a lot about it. And then lastly, like, you know, a place like that is still doing incredible journalism, and what we're doing is trying to build an organization that can rival that, and you know, complete confidence we can do that, and we have our moments, I think, when we do. But that's not something to be trifled with, and sort of I couldn't imagine trying to do this without having had that experience as well.
Okay, so final question before we open it up to the floor. I'd like to hear from each of you what you think the one thing a traditional newsroom or newsroom leader should do in 2013 to make their companies more innovative. David.
Hire really, really, really great people and let them do what they do. That would be the one thing I would say, which hasn't changed regardless of whatever space you're in. But the other thing is, perhaps create separate structures around interdisciplinary teams that can then be empowered to experiment. If you have a print product and a broadcast product or an online product, then shove a whole bunch of people together and experiment and give them the freedom without the priorities and the profit margins that you require for the rest of the business, and let them play.
Okay, Zach?
Give your employees better tools and shuffle around the layout of the newsroom. So we've had a lot of success. It's easier because we're small, but with like a newsroom that's kind of the shape of like this rectangle, and if you went around it, you'd encounter like some reporters, and then there's the team that builds the website, but there are a few of them further down the hall, because in between them are the editor-in-chief and some other reporters and the publisher of the site, and ad sales and marketing is there, but also there, and that kind of intermingling, which was kind of by necessity, has really, really helped enormously. Like we kind of fell into it, that and putting a bunch of whiteboards everywhere on the wall, like
create a really cheap way to create a space where everyone was in the loop and hearing what tech's working on, it like just because they, you know, you're in earshot is not, is like enormously valuable.
And by tools, you mean toys?
Computers and publishing systems. Yeah, I snuck that in because it's like maybe that's more important than the layout. And maybe, you know, buy a subscription to Scribble Live. The large news organizations, perhaps understandably, skimp on hardware. You know, you buy a bulk set of HP laptops, standard issue for everyone. But I don't think the amount of money you save on that purchase is, you know, it's first of all, it's nothing compared to what you wrangle over in terms of salary. So it's like, I think you're actually counting the wrong beans. And in the end, leads to like far greater just efficiency. If your employees have the tools they need to do their jobs, like, you know, that wasn't long ago. This is very, very common now in a lot of newsrooms, but it was not, you know, it didn't happen fast enough. It just makes people's lives easier and makes them happier too.
Michael.
Hire people smarter than you. That would be my first suggestion. And I really think what is going to be hard to do, but they need to do, is adopt the culture of a startup. And what I mean by that is there's this idea that you have to continue to innovate when you have a startup. And just because you're creating content does not mean you cannot continue to innovate. As I mentioned earlier and when I first chatted, you know, a large percentage of content that's being created is still being created in a static form. And I like to say the static web is dead. You know, long live real time. And you're living in that space today. You know, I'm sure all of you are getting notifications right now on your phones. Everything is being delivered faster than, in fact, sometimes than it can be created. And you need to adopt that innovative, real-time startup kind of flavor within the organization. And that, I hope, would allow you to experiment, allow you to challenge the way content gets created, allow you to challenge the way it's published and where it ends up and how fast it gets out there, and allows you to hopefully try different things and see what works. It's like iterate. I mean, you have to try new things in order to find out what is going to be the most successful for the constituents that come to your website. And the only way to find that out is to innovate.
Great, thank you, all three of you. So now we're gonna open it up for questions from the audience. We have about 25, 30 minutes. There's three rules. First is, please go to the microphone that's set up in the middle of the room. Please tell us your name and your affiliation. And the third thing is, and perhaps most importantly, please ensure it's a question and in the form of a question, and a brief form of a question. So you can also tweet us questions using the hashtag CJFJTalk, and we'll try to take as many of those as possible. First up.
Hi, Marissa. How are you?
Hi, Wilf. Good. How are you?
My name is Wilf Dinnick, and for those who I haven't met, I have a startup called OpenFile, which is on pause. The question I have is very specific, and I know everyone sort of danced around it, but I'm actually looking for a hard answer. I got kind of lucky in Canada to raise some money, but I know how hard that is. So when I look at where the resources for innovation will come from, I'm wondering from each one of you where you think that is. Because I've heard from David that, and all of you, that it's very difficult in traditional newsrooms. I don't think anyone blames anyone for not trying. They're trying very hard, but it's very difficult to innovate. Quartz, BuzzFeed, those are far and few between. And when you look at investment in content play, what you hear from a lot of investors is that the fact is, the gold standard is Huffington Post, and if you actually scrape down the numbers, it's not a great business. I mean, it does pretty well, but to beat that is going to be very difficult. So I'm wondering where you think innovation will come from.
Where's the money for innovation?
Where's the resources for innovation? Because if it's going to be tough in the legacy organizations, mm-hmm. and investment's hard to come by in a media play, where you think that's going to come from?
Where's the money, David?
Hey, Wilf. Yeah, I actually take a
if I don't mis- please don't misinterpret me.
Yeah.
I think traditional news traditional news organizations, in my view, at least in Canada, where, let's be honest, the scale is not as large as it is in other countries, still provide the best vehicle or platform to create quality journalism in a disruptive way.
But
I wouldn't be in one if I didn't feel that. Now, to try and answer your question, I didn't talk about it, but I think that when you step back and look then at a newsroom, you really have to look back at the three elements of production, and I've talked about this previously, which are, you know, there's the news gathering element, there's the distribution element, and then there's the sales and marketing element. And newsrooms are, while the rest of the internet has fragmented and become a very modular thing where everybody's capitalizing on different pieces of that, Google and Facebook are really capitalizing on the sales piece of it. Distribution is being capitalized on by YouTube, you know, those kind of things. News organizations have really kept a very integrated business model, which is always revolving around the end output and not looking at those stages in between. And so I would say break it up and look within those three parts of the value network and, or value chain, and see where you can capitalize on it. And the other thing is to question, what is news? And to think about a way that we can redefine news in a new way. I know that it's challenging financially for them as well, but I wrote it down here because I think it's really, really cool. Two things. One, The Walrus, in 2011, in their annual report, they made $538,000 in event marketing. That's 28% of their revenue. Another one, the National Ballet of Canada. I'm engaged and getting married at some point this summer, and we went to get our invitations, and we did it at a place called Paper Things. Paper Things is actually an arm of the National Ballet of Canada, where all of the revenue that comes out of that invitation wedding store goes back into the National Ballet. There are ways, but you have to really rethink what news is in order to start thinking about finding it. So where will the revenue come from? Many different little ways, but you have to, I would argue, you know, step back and look at all of the parts of the chain and how we create news and see if each one can provide a different revenue source.
I think you're really smart to note that the digital media businesses that are typically seen as successes are still not great businesses. Like, the strategy has generally been to grow large enough to be acquired by a larger media outlet. Now, that's great. Certainly the investors in those companies have made off quite well doing that. It will be interesting to see whether, like, the most recent iterations of that model, and Vox Media, like SB Nation, The Verge, and Polygon, if a company like that takes a different tact or not. But there, yeah, there's like their margins are not fantastic. And so, like, the business reporter in me thinks that that's totally right, and then starts to point, perhaps fatalistically again, to more to companies that spent a long time assuring us that they were not media companies, like Google and Twitter, and you know, seeing the obvious signs that they don't say that anymore, and because they quite obviously are media companies. Yeah. The venture capital is more likely to come out of that kind of a shop. I mean, that said, like, I can't disclose our budget, but, like, it's not enormous by any means. And, like, yeah, you know, that whole point is actually we have to be a lean startup. Like, I mean, as all those other examples started as well. And so, you know, scrounge up a benevolent investor, as you know, in our case, the owner of Atlantic Media, David Bradley, is, you know, kindly in funding the operation, but expecting us to turn a profit
in the first year.
No,
Michael.
Hey,
how are you?
Nice to see you again. I'll kind of go back to what I was saying before, and I think the money can come internally, but they have to fundamentally change the way they make money in the digital space, as we keep referring to it.
Are you talking about legacy organizations?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm talking about organizations that are, you know, we're talking about the ones that are looking to, to your question, I mean,
yeah.
I'm saying they need to innovate. I'm saying there's no chance that one of these news organizations is going to create the next Twitter. It's not going to happen. but they can innovate in the way that they make money. And that is, you know, as I was talking about before, you know, anyone who thinks that they're going to survive on CPM and display ads, it's not going to happen. That business is dying. You ask anybody. It's the same thing that's happening, you know, that's happening to television advertising is happening to CPM. There's the return is not there anymore. So there's going to, and I'm a big idea guy, and I believe that there needs to be a new innovation in the way metrics are going to be counted on the internet. And if you look at somebody like Twitter, who's spending a lot of money with the Nielsen ratings guys, and the reason why they're doing that is they want to change what qualifies as engagement. And once that qualification gets released out to the public and starts getting pushed on digital content creators, I think we're going to start to see new revenue opportunities, because all of a sudden you're going to have a situation where when you're sitting 12 minutes on a page, that is going to be different than reading a story for 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be worth a lot more to the organization that can create content that encourages that level of engagement. And you know, that content is going to be up to you, the journalists and the story writer and the storytellers, to create, to ensure that those people stay on those websites and create them. I don't know if that quite answers your question, but yeah. I really don't, you know, I think that that's the innovation I'm talking about. They have to innovate in the way content is delivered and how they're monetizing it.
And I get just one follow-up. I guess my concern is these big media companies, 1% comes from digital, the revenue.
For
and
now.
So,
yeah.
For now, but so you're going to ask them to reallocate a significant amount of human and financial capital into innovation, what they don't know is going to pay off. So that's my point.
Yeah, anyway, and I certainly don't question that. I think one of the areas that we haven't talked about tonight that's kind of critical in all of this is the startup ecosystem that we have in this country. There is a lot of funding. You would probably know where that funding is more than I would in terms of government funding opportunities. And I know that there's a new venture capital fund that's come out that they're now investing in, where they're going to put that money. I guess the question for us as journalists is, are we going to get into that pool of money that's coming out for VC funding? And where are the incubators for that in this country when you have the great example that I am obsessed with and I'm sure you know all about is BetaWorks, which is an incredible incubator of media, pseudo-media. They wouldn't say they're media, but they're pseudo-media companies. Chartbeat, News.me, Dig, all these companies have come out of BetaWorks. Where is our BetaWorks? And I guess that would be my one call to arms is, where is our BetaWorks? And where is the journalism academic community and the private sector community of journalists all teaming together to try and make that happen? And not, I mean, I think we need it.
So you're saying the health of the innovation ecosystem in Canada needs a little TLC from all of us?
Absolutely. I think there is some help coming from the government for digital innovation and digital sector stuff. And you certainly heard a lot of the Liberal leadership candidates talking about how they wanted to be involved in that, Sandra Pupatello to be one. But where's the journalism digital funding in that? And that's kind of my beef, is we're not doing enough as a journalism community in this country to push for that innovation ecosystem.
And speaking of BetaWorks, I recommended reading is this letter that the CEO of BetaWorks just released, this annual letter to shareholders. It's maybe 35 pages long and worth every word however long that would take you to read. And he's actually at this point describing himself as a media company, which is really interesting. And in any event, there's a lot of interesting things. It's worth, everyone should read that this weekend.
One other thing, I don't want to kill questions here, but I think the journalism community, to your point, David, should start thinking about just open, like literally coming together and open sourcing projects. You know, because you know the sum of all of those, you know, innovators within all the organizations across multiple you know, continents, I think you start to get some innovative products coming out that way. But they have to think about, instead of making money off this, how can we all collaborate and make journalism better for everybody?
That's right. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Alex and I work at Global News. I have a question kind of back more to content, which you touched on very briefly at the beginning, and then we started talking about business models. You guys mentioned the difference between, you know, content being produced by citizen journalists and traditional journalists. And during this, I saw actually a story saying that as of tomorrow, the Ontario Superior Court will allow people to live, or allow journalists and lawyers to live tweet the court proceedings and do it on tablets or whatever, but not the general public. So if you're an accredited journalist or you're a lawyer working in it, you can say whatever you want. And I just wanted to get your kind of thoughts on that.
We've got to start with Michael, Mr. Live.
Don't live tweet. Uh-huh. Twitter is down 3 hours today.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Off and on. Well, I would think that in reflecting back to that massive trial, Colonel
Williams.
Yeah. When I look back at that, and I think some of the stuff that was rather racy, you know, coming from some people, I would say that's probably a good thing, that it's going to be in the hands of people who actually know how to tell stories. I don't want to stifle content, but you know, it's really hard to put a perspective on something that, you know, you don't fully understand when you start to, when you're sitting there just writing, you know, writing whatever pops in your head. Now that's the other side of me says, you know, more power. I mean, I'm all for, you know, create as much content as you can and filter it out. So I would argue, okay, fine. It would be great to open it up to anybody who wants to do it. The trouble is Twitter is a public forum. There's no filters there. And you know, I think there's a challenge, you know, around that. You know, I'm not going to say, you know, I'm 100% for just locking it down, but to me, it feels like the best people to tell those kinds of stories are the ones who knows how to tell them. I think David might have something better to say about that. Yeah.
Truthfully, because I don't know. I know there was that ruling coming out, but I don't know enough about it, so I don't want to say anything without reading it. I'll just say in a more generic term that, you know, the citizen journalism versus journalism debate. I suspect we have a panel coming up in a month to make a plug for Andy and Matthew and others that are going to be there. That one, I'm sure, will tackle that. But I will say my thinking on it is that you can have journalism done by citizens, acts of journalism done by citizens. That doesn't necessarily mean they're a journalist. Take that for what you will.
Okay. I would just say that this now puts Ontario way ahead of the U.S. or most courts, require everyone to check their phones and laptops at security. I would disagree, though, with Michael. I think, you know, the whole point of having open courts is that these are accessible to the public, and I'm not comfortable with the idea that the governments make the distinction between who is and who isn't a credentialed journalist. But I, you know, more to the point, love to see more news organizations fight for that. That is, you know, for access to it for everyone, not just because it's the right thing, but I think actually in doing so are more likely to. Because that distinction is going to blur ever more, and so it's like covering our own ass as credentialed journalists to make sure that we're fighting for, you know, leveraging our power, you know, such as we have it now, to get everyone access. And there was some progress with that in the U.S. with the Occupy Wall Street protests and coverage there, where a lot of people covering it were very non-traditional journalists, some activists part of the movement, and you did see admirably a lot of news organizations fighting for their rights because they were, along with more traditional journalists that were harassed by the NYPD, and so that there's good news, I think. But go Ontario.
All right, next question.
Hi there, thanks all for coming out. Lindsay Weeb from McLean's. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about factors for successful innovation within legacy organizations, not individually speaking, but more institutionally. I feel like there was sort of a common thread here, a kind of like fatalistic, scary, any shiny new thing within the institution will sort of be corroded or corrupted. You should separate it and keep it in a special secret place. But I also kind of see that on this panel, you know, with Quartz, which is a sister/, child parent relationship with Atlantic, which I had always known to be one of the great examples of a successful reinvention of a, you know, very preeminent legacy institution of the dead tree variety, which I am, you know, affiliated with. So anything you could say towards what kind of constitutes, what factors lead towards successful innovation on an institutional level, when it happens and why it happens?
And that's a particularly interesting question because Zach's here, and the Atlantic has helped, has successfully navigated those waters better than many other legacy organizations. Zach, do you want to?
Well, so if we start one? If we start with the assumption that the Atlantic and Court separately have been successful in innovating, which I'm happy to allow because just take for granted, then it is a good question because they occurred in two really different ways. So you have the Atlantic, which you know dates to the Civil War and was losing money for decades, turning around. I mean, to put it simplistically, with new management, an owner who decided he was no longer willing to lose money on the magazine, installing new management, and that management doing a bit of, so someone was talking about, the paradox that, we're talking about investing more heavily in digital revenue streams when that's, it's just not there right now to sustain the business, and the Atlantic took that bet. And quickly became a company that makes the majority of its revenue from digital. So that's the very very brief story of the Atlantic's turnaround. So and that is hopeful because right as you say that is a established old old school organization sort of reinventing itself from within. And then with Quartz, one thing that's not this sort of maybe follows part of David's advice about being siphoned off. So we have very heavy and important involvement from the executive team at Atlantic Media Company. They're based in D.C. and we're based in New York, and that's intentional. And we had to create that newsroom. I was trying to poorly lay out for you earlier, and. Literally from scratch, and that was a pain in the ass, but it was really important for embracing this idea that all right, we are separate. We're trying to, and other things too, to the extent possible, separate systems, small things that may seem small, using Dropbox to share files among each other instead of whatever big corporate IT system may exist, or having our own team of developers, both news developers and the developers who build the site itself, on staff reporting, a part of Quartz's payroll, as opposed to taking advantage of the synergy that it's typically why a media company creates new properties, is that you can have these top level departments like tech service. Multiple organizations, which I guess you know very well, and so not doing that was necessary because of the geographic distance, but also really important. And it's not. It's also interesting and been, I think, successful that our wonderful product engineering director reports to my boss, the editor in chief, and that's an interesting relationship too.
But were there other factors that you see from your spot at Quartz in terms of the success of the Atlantic, other than firing all of the management? Were there other parts, kernels of wisdom in that success?
Yeah, the content that there was a cultural acceptance. Justin, the president of the company, talks about just entering the jet stream of digital, sort of not resisting it.
So it came from the top down and sort of imbued the organization.
That is the new management, and I wouldn't discount that, but it. At this point, the magazine content is does extremely well online alongside the web content. But it's notable that I don't think people make that. I mean, I'm not in D.C. hearing them talk about it, but make that distinction. People work for The Atlantic. Some people spend most of their time publishing stuff on theatlantic.com versus someone is laying out the magazine, right? But but it's a pretty well integrated organization, which is actually something we talked about it in the negative, right? We're generally advising against integration of print and digital teams.
But Atlantic is integrated.
Yeah. There's a editor of the website, right? It's integrated to an extent, but I think pretty. It's not as if anyone views the two properties as separate, for sure.
All right, thank you. Next question.
Hi there, I'm Masha Baba from Ryerson School of Journalism, and I'd like to bring this back to content, specifically storytelling and narrative. And I'm wondering, I'm curious about your views on innovation in terms of both these areas, storytelling and narrative, in view of the sort of universe we're talking about.
Okay, so David.
Yeah, happy to. So let me first just set it up by saying we looked at the camera market. And I haven't talked about it tonight, which part of the theory that we worked on was called Jobs to be Done. And we looked at the camera market, which if you look at Flickr statistics over the last 5 years and the trend, people had, 5 years ago, they had little snapshot, point-and-click little cameras. And those really dominated the images that were uploaded to Flickr. But what ended up happening was, as the high end of the market, the DSLRs, became cheaper, a lot of people bought those cameras. And as smartphones had better lenses on them, people started buying those cameras. And what that ended up doing was saying two different jobs were established. And the one job was, I know I'm going to be going to somewhere really nice, and I want to have a good camera, and I'll take a nice picture. And then the low end of the market was served by, I did not expect to be at this fantastic event, but I'm going to take a picture and share it with all my friends. And what ended up happening was the point-and-shoot camera was squeezed from both ends, while the high end and the low end grew. I say all of that preface to say that we would argue that long-form journalism, narrative journalism, investigative journalism, is really a lot satisfying that job of the high-end stuff. So sites like Long Reads, Instapaper, the Atavist, you know, book publishers doing ebook stuff, they're really starting to capture a really positive sign, which is high-end, high-quality journalism at the high end. Then you have sites like Twitter, or platforms like Twitter and Facebook, and short-form content that's going. And what we're seeing is the erosion of that middle area, what we would call commodity news, which is the stuff that everybody gets, and that really, if you were to do a Google search, you'd see 5,000 organizations with the same copy. And so the best way for organizations to be innovative and to stand out from the crowd is to do the high quality long form stuff, or do the short bursts breaking news stuff. And that middle area is going away. I happen to think that's a really good news story, because it's really putting an emphasis on quality and deep diving within specific verticals. And I suspect that QZ is following that kind of model, because it's deep diving on business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really briefly, my boss Kevin talks about the fact that, you know, what we see really clearly from the stats is people want to read really short and they want to read really long. And what they, you know, it's that middle ground, the 800 word story, where you get in a journalistic morass that the readers typically don't care for. What I in particular focus on at Quartz is visual storytelling. So mm-hmm. I work with some folks who are great at data wrangling and data visualization, and I myself am not nearly as good as I'd love to be at that, but you know, the stories I write are typically a mix of text and visual, and you know, I talked about our strategy being, you know, pointed entirely at the social web and stuff that people might be compelled to share. You know, could talk at length about what kind of stuff that is, but one thing we see really strongly is visual content. So one quick example is there was a fire in a garment factory in Bangladesh a month or two ago. More than 100 workers were killed. And a key question for us as a business news site was which multinational clothing retailers were manufacturing clothes in the factory. You know, fortunately, a labor rights group had gone into the factory and recovered clothing labels, you know, singed clothing labels from the factory to document what, in fact, you know, was going on in there. And we could have written a text-based, you know, entirely textual story that said, well, you know, it looks like it's Walmart and Sean Combs' fashion line, et cetera, and called them for comment, et cetera. We did all that, except what fundamentally the piece was showing people the actual clothing labels, because, you know, it was much more emotionally impactful and a different kind of narrative that in that case, you know, worked in making people care about a story that sadly, you know, they're not typically eager to care about.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, just two, very quickly, because it is a good story and it's relevant for this room as well. We broke a story on the Gardner Expressway crumbling, was the real title of it. That story, Global did, that story originated and was germinated from an innovative little standalone group we have within the digital team called the Specials and Interactive Investigative Data Desk, or something confusing.
That's
like
a really
that.
Snappy name.
I know. I think it's Investigative Data Desk. Got it. That story came out of that unit, and it came out of it because we were doing investigative interactive mapping around the Gardner, and through that we were able to then turn it into a broadcast story as well as an online story and amplify it, which was then picked up. Investigative journalism, interactive journalism, data journalism, pretty innovative.
I want to take one more question, but I just want Michael to talk really briefly about these guys were talking about the high end. I think the other interesting idea is the live element. Well, I wouldn't say
mine's
low.
Not the low end, right?
But no. But the short bursts and the live element.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm here as that sort of voice, and I would argue that real time can provide one of the best narratives that people actually will stick with and actually pay attention to. Because when you're reporting, and this is not for all stories, of course, I'm not suggesting that, but when you're reporting on a story that can be told in a progressive way, you know, whether it's a breaking news story or severe weather or sports or elections or trials, anything that you can tell the story over some period of time, what we found is these stories are immensely compelling, because what happens is, as the journalists and as the story is developing in front of their eyes, and it's being told in a way that is extremely compelling to the watcher. And what we've found is these stories get 10, 12, 15 minutes average page time, and no one in here can tell me that anybody spends more than a minute on a static page. It just doesn't happen. And these stories can be both, you know, highbrow, if you want to refer to it as that, and low bursts of morsels of information, along with really compelling, rich media, and that, in my opinion, is where more stories need to go, because you're competing every single day with social media, and social media is not going to stand by and let something go by without somebody tweeting it or somebody posting it to some Facebook page or whatever it's going to do. And you need, I believe, journalism needs to start adopting a continuous story cycle on everything, not just breaking news, but literally every story as it's developing. And I would even argue investigative journalism can be told that way, where you're looking, the end point is a really, you know, compelling story about the investigation and how it went, and a beautiful synopsis of everything that you found during your investigation. But leading up to that story, I think you can get a really compelling narrative that people would follow on how you discovered, where you got the information, why did you decide to go this way rather than that way. And that story is a story in itself.
Okay, I'm going to take one last question really quickly, and then we'll wrap up.
Helen Bagshaw, CBC. I work in radio, TV, and online in a newsroom locally. And I wanted to ask about the breaking news aspect and the getting it right aspect. Can you talk a bit about how do we get the breaking news trajectory, the story you're talking about, Michael, that kind of thing? What's the getting it right part? Because we're in a hurry, we got to do it fast. At the same time, where does the getting it right part fit in? I'd like if you guys could talk a little bit about culturally in these new environments, I'm sort of an assignment editor, so the editorial end of it, how that fits in culturally, but also, you know, as it's breaking, you know, you're talking about filters, which to me sounds a bit like the old-fashioned way of doing things in a newsroom. So
I don't talk about filters.
Okay, so I'm gonna can I just paraphrase, because I want to direct it a little bit. Maybe David, can you talk about the drive to get it right and how you get it first and right at the same time, how you guys balance that from a cultural perspective? And then we'll come back to Michael.
Yeah. So all the statistics show that once something is out there, even a correction, it's out there, it's gone. So essentially, I hope, and some of my awesome team is here, they can correct me afterwards and let you all know, but I'd like to think that we don't place an emphasis on being first, that we make sure we try and get it right.
you know, maybe I'm crazy, but that's kind of the way we've done it, where if we sense a story's coming, there's emails that are exchanged saying, guys, just keep an eye out. There are also tools like Storyful Pro, which is a good one to use to make sure that what you're seeing is can be verified.
Yeah.
But we've all had our moments where we've learned from someone dying who didn't die and then have learned to correct it.
So I'm going to wrap up, and if there are any other questions, we're all going to be here and hanging around, and they're pouring the wine right now. Thank you all so much for coming out and for asking great questions, for the fantastic conversations, and I'm going to ask Bob to come back up, say a few closing remarks.
That really was a terrific panel. Thank you very much. And Marissa, thank you for steering it so well. Before we wrap up, I just want to make a mention of something that's been alluded to here already. It's our next JTalk on February 28th. Kathy English, the public editor of The Star, is going to moderate a discussion on media practices in the wake of Newtown. It'll feature Andy Carvin, the celebrated media guy from NPR, Esther Ankin, the new CBC ombud, and Matthew Ingram, who's here tonight. So we hope you'll join us February 28th, and I hope you join us for a little refreshment. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. It was not a trend.